Well, we're continuing our series through the first half of the book of Daniel, and today, as we come to chapter 5, a new character emerges on the scene, a man named Belshazzar. While the text refers to him as king, you know, in a technical sense, he's probably more like a viceroy. He's a ruler who's actually exercising authority on behalf of someone else. You see, history records that he was the son of King Nabonidus and appears to have been acting ruler in Babylon during his father's 10-year absence from the capital city. So, for all intents and purposes, from the perspective of most people, he was their ruler, Belshazzar. And so referring to him as king makes sense in the text. Well, as our chapter opens, we find ourselves in the midst of a great royal party. King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. While Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, might drink from them. So they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, drank from them. As they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Suddenly, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster on the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. The king watched as the hand wrote. His face turned pale, and he was so frightened that his legs became weak and his knees were knocking. Okay, so here we are in the middle of this royal party. Everyone's having a great time. And at some point, as the party wears on, Belshazzar has an idea. He remembers that somewhere in long-term storage are goblets of gold and silver that had been taken years earlier from the temple of the Israelite God. So he asks for them to be brought out to the party. And then before you know it, they're filling them with wine and they're drinking in honor of the gods of Babylon. And then something completely unexpected and unnerving happens next. A hand appears. Not a hand attached to a body, it seems, just a hand. And it starts writing on the wall. And as we'll see in a moment, you know, while the king sees what is written, he either can't read it or he doesn't know what it means. Well, at least on one level, he doesn't know what it means. On another level, he knows. He knows enough to recognize that it's not good news, whatever it is. So he tries to solve his problem in a way that we've already seen others try twice before in the book of Daniel. He calls in the experts. Verse 7. The king summoned the enchanters and astrologers and diviners, and then he said to those wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and tells me what it means will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around his neck, and he will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom." Now, of course, by this time in the book, we already know what to expect. These guys have already struck out twice before. Why would this time be any different? And sure enough, it's more of the same. Verse 8. Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or tell the king what it meant. So Belshazzar became even more terrified, and his face grew more pale. His nobles were baffled. The queen, hearing the voices of the king and his nobles, came into the banquet hall. "May the king live forever," she said. "Don't be alarmed. Don't look so pale. There's a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. In the time of your father, he was found to have insight and intelligence and wisdom like that of the gods. Your father, King Nebuchadnezzar, appointed him chief of the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. He did this because Daniel, whom the king called Belshazzar, was found to have a keen mind and knowledge and understanding, and also the ability to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve difficult problems. Call for Daniel, and he'll tell you what the writing means." Now, the queen referred to here is most probably the queen mother. We've been told earlier that the king's wives and concubines are already with him, partying with him. And this figure comes from outside the banquet. Her knowledge of past happenings in the court and her explaining them to Belshazzar also seems to indicate that she's got far more experience about royal happenings than Belshazzar has. Her suggestion? Call Daniel, who seems to have a habit of succeeding where the whole lot of the sages of the land have only failed. So the king does, but I'd suggest he's not really thrilled about this plan. Verse 13. So Daniel was brought before the king, and the king said to him, "Are you Daniel, one of the exiles my father the king brought from Judah?" Notice that the king seems to go out of his way to identify Daniel as a conquered foreigner. It's like he wants to make sure that this local folk hero that the queen mother has been boasting about is adequately put in his place right off the bat. He wants Daniel to be reminded of who's in charge and who's not. He continues, "I have heard that the spirit of the gods is in you and that you have insight, intelligence, and outstanding wisdom. The wise men and enchanters were brought before me to read this writing and tell me what it means, but they could not explain it. Now I've heard that you are able to give interpretations and solve difficult problems. If you can read this writing and tell me what it means, you will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around your neck, and you will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom." Then Daniel answered the king, "You may keep your gifts for yourself and give your rewards to someone else. Nevertheless, I will read the writing for the king and tell him what it means." Now, just as an aside, to anticipate what might look like a bit of an inconsistency on Daniel's part, you know, here he's nicely telling the king to stuff it when it comes to the reward he's offering. And yet by the end of the chapter, he'll actually accept it. Now, the text doesn't tell us why, but it may simply be that, Daniel wants to make sure that the king knows clearly that his reading and interpretation of this inscription comes free of charge. He's not doing it for the purpose of gaining an earthly reward, even if one is ultimately given. Or maybe Daniel, having already read the inscription and knowing what it means, realizes that the reward actually is meaningless and empty because the king, it will turn out, has nothing of substance to give that's going to last more than about 24 hours. Daniel continues, and for whatever tactics Belshazzar may be used to intimidate him off the start, Daniel delivers a stinging rebuke to this foreign ruler. "Your Majesty, the Most High God gave your father Nebuchadnezzar sovereignty and greatness and glory and splendor. Because of the high position he gave him, all the nations and peoples of every language dreaded and feared him. Those the king wanted to put to death, he put to death. Those he wanted to spare, he spared. Those he wanted to promote, he promoted. And those he wanted to humble, he humbled. But when his heart became arrogant and hardened with pride, he was deposed from his royal throne and stripped of his glory. He was driven away from the people and given the mind of an animal. He lived with the wild donkeys and ate grass like the ox, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he acknowledged that the Most High God is sovereign over all the kingdoms of the earth and sets over them anyone he wishes. But you, Belshazzar, his son, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. Instead, you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You had the goblets from his temple brought to you, and you and your nobles, your wives and your concubines, drank wine from them. You praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which cannot see or hear or understand. But you did not honor the God who holds in his hand your life and all your ways. Therefore, he sent the hand that wrote the inscription. This is the inscription that was written: Mene, Mene, Tekel, Pharsin. Mene, Mene, Tekel, Pharsin. These words can actually be read two different ways. As nouns, they're measurements of weight. So mene is a mina, which is just over half a kilogram. Tekel is about 11 grams. Farsin is usually a reference to half a mina, though it can also refer to half a shekel. So as a phrase, it kind of comes across as something you might hear a merchant calling out from the marketplace as he's selling his wares, you know, letting people know the cost of what he's selling, you know, something like a dollar, a penny and two quarters. But at another level, the lettering on the wall also indicates three passive verbs. Mene means numbered or appointed. Tekel, evaluated. Farsin, divided. And so from that perspective, the message to Belshazzar seems to be this. Belshazzar, you have been appointed and now evaluated and punished. Daniel expands on it in this way. He says, here's what these words mean. Mene, God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. Parsin, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Then at Belshazzar's command, Daniel was clothed in purple, a gold chain was placed around his neck, and he was proclaimed the third highest ruler in the kingdom. That very night, King Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain, and Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. Well, you know, as we reflect on this story today and the demise of Belshazzar, certainly there are a number of things to point to as missteps on the part of the king. Well, I think in our story, Belshazzar demonstrates a sense of arrogance, a sense of pride. I think there seems to be an embrace of excess in the party he's throwing. There's clear evidence of idolatry taking place. But what jumps out to me above all those things, or maybe more to the point, what seems to be kind of the accumulation of all those things, is this issue of blasphemy, treating as common that which God has made holy. And when Belshazzar does that, God decides it's time to step in. Now, in chapter 1, when Nebuchadnezzar besieged Jerusalem and he ultimately conquered the city, you may remember that the writer added this specific little detail into the mix. He mentioned that the articles from the temple were removed, carried off to Babylon, and were put into the treasure house of his god. Now, I'm pretty sure that probably wasn't God's favorite move by this foreign king, and yet nothing more is said of it in the book until we get to chapter 5. The inclusion of this detail about the temple items in chapter 1 appears to be like a setup for our story today, making them an important part of deciphering the meaning of the chapter. The critical issue, you see, isn't simply that Belshazzar and his entourage are partying. The main offense is not even that they're partying in honor of their gods instead of the god. No, I think the real issue at play is that they're doing all of this with the sacred items that had been taken out of God's temple. See, it was one thing that these items had been stolen, or even stored in a foreign temple. But it crossed a whole other line when they were used in alien worship. I mean, just think for a moment about how the tabernacle and the later temple functioned. You know, they weren't like sort of our church building, you know, where anyone can sort of go anywhere and do anything. I mean, so far as I know, no one has ever been struck by lightning by stepping onto our sanctuary platform without carrying the title of pastor. But in the temple, there were restrictions of access. And the further you move towards the inward part of the temple, the fewer people there were who were allowed to gain access. The holy place was supervised by consecrated people, by the priests. And certain rites and rituals, notably sacrifices, had to be observed in order to gain entrance into the presence of God. There was this sharp and definite division between the holy and the profane. Now, just a quick note about definitions. I think today we tend to use the word profane to talk about things that are, you know, vulgar or bad. But when we look at how the Bible uses the word, I mean, profane can mean those things, but more broadly, it carries a definition of that which is common. You see, profane is a combination of two words, the prefix pro, meaning in front or out, in front of or outside, and phanum, which means temple. The profane was that which stood outside of the sacred zone. And so the word profane simply describes anything and everything that doesn't fit into the category of sacred. So back to our story. The temple vessels used in Belshazzar's party were associated with the sacred place in the temple, and therefore were part of the realm of the sacred. Belshazzar was not, you know, partying with profane cups. I mean, these were not coffee mugs stolen from the priest's staff room. These were the vessels set aside to worship God with. And as such, God expected that they would be treated as holy. Belshazzar's decision to treat the holy as profane crossed a line that God would not overlook. So what do we make of that today? I mean, what parallels might we draw between then and now? Is there even any real connection between the world of this story and our world today on this side of the cross? Well, I do think that we see a shift around this idea of holiness from what we see in the Old Testament to what we discover after Jesus' death and resurrection. Jesus ushers in a new era where it seems that the landscape in terms of, you know, the secular or the profane and the holy has changed. Maybe the most visceral picture of this is being that one of the results, you know, a byproduct of Jesus' work on the cross is that the curtain in the temple was torn in two. The whole purpose of that curtain was to separate the holy place from the most holy place, to make sure that they were treated as different realms before God. And by the destruction of the curtain, that separation seems to be done away with. And the question is, to what end? I mean, what are we left with when the distinction between the holy and the profane seems to have, to some degree anyway, been done away with? Is it that now nothing is holy anymore? Nothing is sacred? Or is it the opposite? Is it now that everything is holy? Everything is sacred? Well, I think that the Old Testament, you know, can help us answer that question as we look at a passage that anticipates the day when this division between the sacred and the common would undergo a change. The prophet Zechariah wrote of a day that would be future to him. And he said this, he said, "On that day, holy to the Lord will be inscribed on the bells of the horses, and the cooking pots in the Lord's house will be like the sacred bowls in front of the altar. Every pot in Jerusalem and Judah will be holy to the Lord Almighty. And all who come to sacrifice will take some of the pots and cook in them. And on that day, there will no longer be a Canaanite in the house of the Lord Almighty." Now, from an Old Testament perspective, this is a massive, monumental shift. Zechariah predicts a time when, for example, the common cooking pots would have the same value as the sacred bowls at the altar. Why? Because every pot and bowl would now be holy to God. Zechariah predicts a day when there will no longer be a foreigner in the house of the Lord. Why? Because there would no longer be one person considered alien or profane, not one worshiper considered an outsider, not one man or woman excluded on the grounds of being unfit for the worship of the Lord of hosts. Zechariah even says that the day would come when holy to the Lord would be inscribed on the bells of the horses. Now, to fully appreciate this change, it's helpful to know that this phrase, holy to the Lord, was in Old Testament days engraved on a plate of pure gold and then attached to the turban of the high priest. It's also probably important to know that throughout much of the Old Testament, the attitude towards horses was actually quite negative. Not only were they amongst the unclean animals, but they also tended to represent war and judgment. Whereas most kings of that day would ride horses, the Old Testament predicts that the coming Messiah would ride a donkey instead. Again, it reflects this attitude of disparagement towards horses. Bottom line, in the Old Testament, horses are saddled, excuse the pun, with a host of negative connotations. So to say that the day would come when horses would wear bells inscribed with this phrase that was worn on the turban of the high priest, holy to the Lord, that indicates quite a twist in the biblical narrative. Even horses would one day be holy objects in the sight of the Lord. Indeed, it seems that the difference on this side of the cross is not that there is nothing holy, but rather it seems that maybe everything is now holy. In spite of that, it can be so easy for us to simply slip back into a dualistic approach to the world where we maintain these categories of sacred and profane. Now, we might not use those words, but sometimes our actions belie the fact that those distinctions are still alive and well. You know, we tithe 10% of what we earn, setting it aside for God's use, and that is good. But if we see that as God's portion and the rest as ours to use as we'd like, have we not now made a distinction between the holy and the profane? We talk about the sanctity of the marriage relationship, and well, we should. But do we also recognize that when Jesus, by his death and resurrection, has made his followers brothers and sisters, that in fact, all our relationships are holy ground? When there are things that we deem not appropriate for our worship center or for a church building, but we don't think twice about those same things when we're in our own homes, have we not arbitrarily made one of part of God's creation more holy than another part because we attribute his presence more in one space than another? When we use language like making time for the Lord, does that mean that we assume that there's also time that isn't the Lord's? Like he's only interested in what we do with his time, but we're free to do with our time whatever we want. When we refer to pastors and missionaries and parachurch workers as those who are doing the Lord's work, while other work is considered to be in the secular realm, I mean, are we not demonstrating a belief that what most of us do 40 hours plus a week doesn't really matter to God like those spiritual jobs? When in reality, those who work in the areas of science and medicine and education and home building and repair, you know, the list goes on. Those people are making the kind of difference in God's world that matters greatly to him and therefore is, in fact, sacred from God's perspective. What other areas of life can you think of where we have this tendency to still think and act in terms of a dichotomy between the profane and the sacred? I wonder, how might all these different parts of life that we've talked about be different if we could consider them through the eyes of God? You know, back to Zechariah, and specifically this, you know, this picture he gives of horses literally wearing the inscription, holy to the Lord. Like, I wonder, how might our approach to life change if we could physically, like, see God put his stamp, holy to the Lord, on all these different parts of our lives? You know, imagine him stamping, holy to the Lord, on your bank account and on the front of your home. Imagine your marriage and your relationship with your kids, your friendships with other brothers and sisters in Christ, all bearing the inscription, holy to the Lord. Imagine God writing holy to the Lord on your work and on your recreational activities. What would change if you saw God literally put that inscription on all the different parts of your life? I want to suggest that just because you can't see a physical inscription like the one that was worn by the priests in the Old Testament, it doesn't mean it's not there. And I think we would do well to live with that in mind. So back to our story today. You know, Belshazzar's great sin, Belshazzar's undoing, was committing an act of blasphemy. For us to reduce blasphemy to just, you know, careless words that are spoken or to defacing a church or a cross, that would be to miss the point entirely. Blasphemy is treating as common that which God has called holy. And so my prayer for each one of us is that we will have eyes to see and hearts to understand. that everything God puts a claim on in his good universe is holy. And may we be those who understand how broad God's claims are, how they permeate every part of our lives, not just the spiritual parts. To steal a phrase from Kenneth Herman, Christianity is not a realm of life. It is a way of life for every realm. I think the more we come to understand that truth, the more we'll recognize how much in our world God has made holy through Jesus. Let's pray. And so, God, might we more and more come to understand the great gift and privilege we have of living in this world that you've created, a world which you declared to be good, a world which you didn't abandon when sin entered, but rather set in motion a plan to reclaim all the goodness of creation, a plan in which you work to redeem and restore and reclaim every realm of our existence. May we see holy to the Lord inscribed on every part of our lives, our money, our time, our work, our recreation, our words, our possessions, our relationships. And in living in this way, may the world around us see your holiness in and through our lives, to your glory and your honor. I ask all of these things in Jesus' name. Amen.